This is Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Time banks have been cropping up across the country as an alternative method of community building. There's one just starting here in Lansing. Very loosely, participants in a time bank trade work hours in a common effort toward community improvement. But there's way more to it than that, and here to give us a much better explanation of what time banks do is Edge Brussel, coordinator of the new time bank here in Lansing. Welcome.
Hello.
And also joining us by phone from Madison, Wisconsin, Stephanie Rierich. She's the co-director of the thriving Dane County Time Bank there. Welcome, Stephanie.
Good morning.
Let's start out with just a good working rudimentary definition of what a time bank is. Stephanie, you want to take that?
Sure. Well, some of the listeners will have heard of a babysitting co-op, and if you have, it's like a babysitting co-op, but for everything. So it's a place where we bank our time. It's a mutual credit network, so we get together and decide to extend credit to each other. And what that means is we list what people have to offer each other, and it can be very simple things from walking a dog or calling someone to check in on them to something like teaching a language or fixing a computer. And every hour I spend helping another member in the time bank, I get an hour in my account, and I can turn around and use that to help another member. I mean, to get help from another member, so I can teach you a piano lesson 1 month, and the next month I can get my computer fixed. And it's very flexible. I can spend hours before I earn them or vice versa. And really the goal is to connect people and match unmet needs with unused resources. So besides really connecting needs, connecting people with what they need, it really connects people with each other who they wouldn't have met otherwise. So it's a great way to build community and then also pool resources, which we'll talk about more later.
How do you get the members though? How do you start this whole thing?
Well, everybody has something they need, and one thing that a lot of people in this country really need desperately is more of a sense of community. So I've found that it's very that it's a pretty easy sell when you start talking with people about it, and you just really need to start by getting a group of people together who are interested in making these kinds of exchanges. And for us, it's spread a lot via word of mouth, and the trick is getting a diverse enough group of people who have really different needs and assets from each other so you can really get the exchanges flowing. And for us, it really made a big difference to really bring people together around common community goals and view our time bank as a way that we pool our resources to be able to work together to meet goals like restorative justice or health and wellness access or energy efficiency, those kinds of things.
Edge, what's it like getting Lansing's time bank started?
You know, people that I've spoken to are very receptive and excited about this getting started. I think everyone that I've spoken to has wanted to become involved, is excited that this is happening. I haven't really had anyone think it's a bad idea for the community. I think it is a pretty easy sell. Neighbors need to get to know their neighbors. We need to transition away from this economy of strangers to an economy of trust.
And everybody needs something, and everybody's got something to give. So, I mean, that makes the exchange really, theoretically at least, it makes it really quite feasible. Stephanie, it sounds like a great idea, but also one that would be difficult to get momentum going. What does it take? You're up and running. You're successful. What does it really take to become successful?
It really just takes energy from the people involved. A time bank is exactly, well, it's greater than the sum of its parts, but the parts need to be active and participating. And that's why I mentioned bringing people together around common goals is extremely helpful. So one of the goals for us was really changing the dynamic of how many kids we're sending to prison or getting into the prison system. So a goal for us was to start a restorative justice youth court program, and it resonates with a lot of people here. A lot of people really want to see something change there, so it's an easier thing to get people involved in. And people are used to volunteering or working in situations where they have structure and they go in and know what they're supposed to do. And it's really helped our time bank to actually put some structure around some of the work that people do in the time bank, partly because that's what people are used to. And also it's more exciting when you're motivated by something that's where you're really doing something in your community that you want to see happen.
So it's practical and it's idealistic at the same time.
Yeah,
really,
absolutely.
In a way. It can be both. Edge, do you have a particular focus like that for Lansing's Time Bank?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is we want the the people that join to bring their focus. But right now, the two focuses that we have are food. Right now, Lansing's economy is tied to the national economy. It's tied to the rise and fall. And right now, we want to take that and shift it to being sustainable and being able to create our own food, get more people out growing food, teaching people how to prepare that food and store it for the winter. Our other focus is on collaborating to educate each other, to teach each other and to reskill, to help share what we know with the people around us.
What do you need most right now? Do you just need to get the word out about this thing? How are you approaching growing the Lansing Time Bank?
Yeah. We need people involved on all levels. First of all, I would say if this is an idea that excites you, we would love to come to your neighborhood and go door to door with you and talk to your neighbors and invite them to a community potluck of your neighbors to talk to the individuals that are closest to you about what the needs of your neighborhood are. We need people to just join and be excited about being on the system. We need people on all levels to help us.
Okay. Stephanie, any advice you feel you can offer Edge as she launches Lansing's Time Bank?
I would say keep doing what you're doing, and the things that you're focusing on now are great, and just the ideas that you have about how to connect with people. So that's the main thing. It spreads best through word of mouth and with people understanding that it's really what you make of it. So you can build something really beautiful and exciting when you get the people involved.
A question for both of you. Stephanie, how do you respond to people who say, I love all your goals, but I really don't feel like I've got anything to offer. I've got really anything to give. How do you respond to those comments?
If you're speaking to me right now, you have something to offer. You could call people and check in on them or visit with people. And a lot of the things that are really in demand are very simple things like companionship and recreation and transportation. So everyone has something to offer. I would just have a conversation with the person and find out what they like to do. One thing that is good about the Time Bank is it gives you a chance to do more of what you like and less of what you don't like.
Edge, any response to that? Have you encountered that response yet? I love the idea of making the community a better place. I'm all about food and education, but I really got nothing to share.
I would say the community needs you. I spoke to an elderly woman, and she came up to me and said that same thing. She took my hand and said, this is great, but I don't have anything to offer. Yeah. And I spent 5 minutes talking to her about, the things that she loved to do when she was younger. And she said, I used to keep a garden, but I obviously can't do that anymore. And, we suggested to her, what if we got a group of kids to come over and you could teach them how to garden? And her face lit up. Everyone has something to offer, just as Stephanie said.
Stephanie, how important is funding? Can you get the lion's share of your work done with a modest amount of funding, or could you really use cash here?
We could all really use cash, and we tend to operate on shoestrings. And, we are running 4 youth court locations. We have a Time Bank store. We're a partner in Energy Co-op, really building an energy efficiency program. And we have a wellness project. And we do all that with what's, for a lot of Time Banks, a large budget, about $200,000. But when you think about all the activity that's happening, it's a pretty small budget. So we are able to stretch our money pretty far. But at the same time, people who are working on it full-time still need to pay mortgages and pay for the lion's share of their energy and food with in the cash economy. So we do need to pay people with money, and so we're always looking for funding. And so if you're listening to this and you want to donate to the Lansing Time Bank, I encourage you to, because they'll need funding to get started.
But you can get a lot done with partnerships, though, correct?
Yes, tons. Yeah.
Edge, where are you looking at for partnerships?
Yeah. So, first, I just wanted to say, in talking to the other Time Banks, we've learned that, one of the main reasons why Time Banks fail is that they start out with a beginner grant, and then that grant doesn't get renewed, or they have one coordinator who is paid, and then that pay goes away, and the Time Bank sort of collapses. Mm. So we're trying to figure out how to do this with as many community partners, caring about nesting Time Banking within their model. We're specifically reaching out to people in the food movement, to the Gardening Network, but really any nonprofit. A partnership between the Time Bank and any nonprofit organization will help and support both. Because if a nonprofit is able to start giving time dollars as an incentive to their volunteers, they will help ward off volunteer burnout, and they'll have people excited about being part of this local currency. So,
mm-hmm. Stephanie, how exactly did you get the juvenile justice system and the school districts on board? What were those conversations like? How big a job was that?
It was pretty significant, and as you referred to it, partners and champions. We approached people right off the bat who were involved in that aspect of the system who we thought had common values. So we found our allies in that system and started communicating with them right away. And it was at least a year-long process before we actually started the youth court, and then we started it, and then we had to be up and running on a really small pilot, sort of under the radar scale, and then people noticed the results we were having and picked it up more. So for us, a lot of it is just pulling together who you can and starting something on a small scale, because people have a hard time grasping the possibilities of something brand new to them until they see a little bit of the evidence.
Edge Brussel, we've got some number of listeners who are interested enough in this to place a phone call or visit a website. Where do people go?
Absolutely. So first off, you could like us on Facebook, greaterlansing.com, Greater Lansing Time Bank at Facebook. You can email us at greaterlansingtimebank@gmail.com. You can call us at 517-862-0422. Again, that's 517-862-0422. And greaterlansingtimebank@gmail.com. We will also be at the Avenue Cafe next Tuesday, Tuesday the 19th. The Avenue Cafe on Michigan Avenue will have a big sign that says Greater Lansing Time Bank. Please come talk to us.
Edge Brussel is the organizer of the new Lansing Time Bank. Stephanie Rerick joined us by phone from Madison, Wisconsin, the Dane County Time Bank. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been 100 years since the International Joint Commission conducted a Great Lakes-wide bacteriological study. Scientists are now looking to recreate the 1913 study. The 100-year study will assess how water quality in the Great Lakes Basin has changed over time. Lead researcher Dr. Joan Rose is the Nowland Center Chair of Water Research, co-director of the Center for Water Sciences, and co-director of the Center for Advancing Microbial Risk Assessment here at Michigan State. Dr. Rose said that they started the study in 1913 because people were getting sick.
During that time, they were having a lot of typhoid outbreaks, and drinking water was the problem. So people were drinking the water, the wastewater was going into our water supply, and people were getting sick. And in fact, some of the largest outbreaks occurred in Detroit and Chicago, and people were getting sick and dying. And in the early 1900s, Canada and the U.S. recognized the value of the Great Lakes, and they created an agreement to manage the Great Lakes together. And one of the first things they realized was that there was this great, layer of pollution. So they did this study using the most advanced microbiological techniques of the time to look at the fecal pollution around the Great Lakes. It was spread completely across the whole region, and it's still today, 100 years later, one of the largest studies ever done on a large water basin.
Hmm. Now, the new study you're looking to do is, in a sense, is to recreate this 1913 study. Is it fair to ask what you're expecting to find?
We get asked all the time, has the water gotten better or worse?
Sure.
What's the water quality like? And so many things have changed. Our instinct is to say, for sure, the water has gotten better. We're smarter. We're treating our wastewater now. We have the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act. But then we start to think about it a little bit more. There's more people, there's more animals, there's more waste going into our system, there's more combined sewer overflows. Climate has changed. We certainly know that in the last 20 years, we're getting greater precipitation, which leads to more stormwater. We've lost wetlands. So there's so many things that have changed. And we really haven't looked at this historical perspective over this long time to answer that simple question. Has our water quality gotten better or worse in the Great Lakes in regard to fecal pollution?
And you hope this study will once and for all answer that question.
We think that this study will help us answer that. And we'd like to, there's You know, the resources in the Great Lakes, it's not just the water resources. It's the intellectual resources. Both on the Canada and the U.S. side, there's so many great scientists that have been studying this system. And we have a lot of data. In fact, right in Lake Sinclair, we looked at data from the 1940s all the way to current time where they'd been monitoring their water quality. And we took it out of old notebooks that had been handwritten. And it was amazing, you know, the amount of data that's out there. So we think that there's data out there to be mined that we can analyze. And we also think that in the last 5 years, the new techniques are giving us new insight into pollution, not just how much pollution is there, but where is it coming from? Because that's the second question that we've always been asking and never been able to answer.
Now, are you referring to technology creating pollution, or are you talking about technology detecting pollution,
yeah,
or both?
I'm talking about both, but in this regard, I'm talking about the new technology that allows us to test water, and when we take a sample, we're able to identify the source of the fecal pollution. This is called microbial source tracking, and it's sort of the CSI of water, we like to call it. You know, the CSI of water. And we use some of the same techniques that you see on television shows and in the courtroom. We actually look at the DNA of bacteria in water, and we can tell whether it's come from sewage in humans or whether it's come from birds.
How about that? So fecal pollution is still a focus of the current study?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
It's very interesting. In 1913, of course, they were very worried about drinking water. And people, getting quite ill. And in today, 100 years later, we've seen a shift, and partly because of engineering technology in treating our drinking water, but we've seen this shift from worrying so much about drinking water, we've done a very good job there, to worrying about our beaches, our coastline, our ecosystems, and the economics, you know, that coastline provides, both from fishing and tourism, all kinds of things. So we've seen a shift, and there's certainly what appears to be in the record an increasing threat of fecal pollution to our shoreline.
Who's working on the study?
We have a very large group very interested in this study. We have about 20 core people that are coalescing together, and they represent scientists from NOAA, the Great Lakes Environmental Research Lab, from the USGS. They represent scientists at health departments and state agencies, as well as private laboratories and academic scientists like myself. And so we have a very large group representing almost every state in the U.S. That border the Great Lakes and on the Canada side as well.
There's a lot of different work being done in the Great Lakes, and a lot of those studies take a lake-by-lake approach. This study you're embarking on is basin-wide. Why look basin-wide, and what might we learn that we wouldn't studying lake-by-lake?
When you start to look at time and space, changes over time and space, we get a better sense of our lessons learned on what we should do right. There are some site-specific issues that we need to address. But what's interesting, if you look at these maps, this is the original GIS in 1913, hand-drawn maps of the pollution, and you look at those and you overlay them with today's areas of concern, they are very, very similar. And so we know where these hotspots are. What we don't know about these hotspots is, are they similar in terms of sources of pollution, health risk, and management strategies to control that pollution?
Looking globally, the Great Lakes are the largest group of freshwater lakes on Earth. The Great Lakes must have an impact globally as well. Am I right?
Yeah. You know, when you look at all the international basins around the world, and there's something like 260-some water systems that are shared by more than one country, and in some cases, three, four, five countries. the Great Lakes is still, Canada and the U.S. still has the best agreement around water quality. And when you think about it, you know, quantity, when we think about quantity, a glass of water, how much water's flowing in that stream, how much rain falls, how much stormwater, et cetera. We can get our arms around quantity. But quality is very complex. It's what contaminants, where are they coming from? Do they cause us harm? How do we get rid of them? Are there new contaminants? So it's so complex. And the Great Lakes has a water quality agreement that is a model for all over the world. And water quality equals health. There's no doubt about it. Equals health for humans, equals health for animals and our wildlife, our ecosystem, and our economics. So water quality is health. And we need to get our arms around that. And I think the Great Lakes Agreement, the studies that have gone on in the past, and the new work that's going to happen in the Great Lakes is really a model globally for the big basins, the Ganges River in India, you know, the Yangtze in China, you know, and we can go on and on. There's just so much need for good science to address water quality and health in the future.
Has it been a long time since a lot of those global water systems have been studied, just like in the Great Lakes? Has it been decades or years?
Yes, and in many cases, it's so piecemeal in the rest of the world in terms of studying water quality that you really can't even find a map of water quality globally around fecal pollution. You can find some maps on arsenic and fluoride, some of the groundwater pollutants that are naturally occurring because they're part of the geological formation. But if you try to find a good global map on water quality, you cannot find one. And some of these very important systems, I mean, the World Bank is going to fund a lot of money for restoration of the Ganges. Look at what we've been doing in the Great Lakes in terms of restoration, protection, and addressing future concerns. This is a global model. There's no doubt about it.
Dr. Joan Rose is the Nolan Endowed Chair of Water Research, co-director of the Center for Water Sciences, and co-director of the Center for Advancing Microbial Risk Assessment at Michigan State University. She is the lead researcher on the 100-year study, which is reevaluating water quality in the Great Lakes a century after the International Joint Commission 1913 project. Dr. Rose, thanks very much.
Well, thanks for having me.
Up next on Current State, Universal Fundamentals, a conversation on the Higgs boson particle, and I'll speak with the co-author of the recent book, The Color of Christ, The Son of God and the Story of Race in America. That's next on Current State. Stay with us. In 1964, physicists including Peter Higgs theorized that a subatomic particle existed that would help explain the creation of the universe, a particle that gives everything in the universe mass. It became known as the Higgs boson. Scientists at the European Organization for Nuclear Research, or CERN, announced that they'd found a particle they described as Higgs-like. After completing their examination of the data, lead researcher Joe Incandela announced that, in his words, it is clear that we are dealing with a Higgs boson. The research continues, but discovery of a Higgs boson would leap to the top of Nobel Prize contenders. And joining us to help us understand this story is Joey Houston, a professor in the MSU Physics and Astronomy Department. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And since the vast majority of our listeners are something other than physicists, can you describe what the Higgs boson might be and help us understand the importance of this discovery, please?
So this is something fundamental we've learned about the structure of the universe and how it functions. We know that there, or at least we believe that there is a field, an energy field that permeates all of space called the Higgs field. And when particles interact with this Higgs field, they interact with different strengths. So those that interact very strongly with the Higgs field acquire a very large mass. Those that don't interact very strongly at all acquire a very low mass. So the Higgs particle or Higgs field is responsible for giving mass to the particles in the universe. The Higgs boson is a manifestation of this field. And again, as you said, it's something that we've known that should exist, or something like it should exist, back since 1964. We've been searching for it, you know, basically since then. And again, this is a real culmination, the fact that now we finally have strong evidence from the two experiments at the CERN Large Hadron Collider, ATLAS and CMS, that the Higgs boson actually exists.
Dr. Elizabeth Simmons of Michigan State's Physics and Astronomy also joins us here this morning. Can you help us understand the concept of mass, though? I hear that word, and I think weight, I guess, is what I think of. I think in the popular imagination, it's something like weight. Can you help us understand the concept of mass a little bit better? Because that's what the Higgs boson is really all about.
Absolutely, Mark. So mass, probably the clearest thing would be the sense of resistance to changing how something is moving, inertia. So imagine you're in mire, you're pushing your grocery cart. If your grocery cart does not have much in it, it doesn't have a lot of mass, it's pretty easy to steer it where you want it to go. But if you load it up with cases and cases of cola products, there's suddenly a lot of mass there. And if it starts going in one direction, it's hard to stop it or turn it. So that sense of inertia or resistance to a change in motion, that's what mass is.
Is it closely related to the concept of weight, though, as we would understand it?
Sure. As we would understand it here on Earth, the main force that we notice acting on massive objects is gravity. And mass times a constant that has to do with the local strength of gravity here on Earth is the weight of an object. So they are very closely related.
MSU has researchers at the Large Hadron Collider, Joey Houston, where this research has been conducted. Do you know of any links between Michigan State and the Higgs boson project?
Yes. I mean, we have a large contingent of people who are working on the ATLAS experiment. We started in 1994, so the timescale for these experimental projects is very long term. We started constructing the detector in 1998 and finished in 2003. And from 2003 to 2008, we were installing it, you know, just to try to make it operational. So there's 8 faculty, you know, from Michigan State on the Large Hadron Collider, 5 postdoctoral research associates, 5 graduate students at the moment, and a large number of undergraduates through the years. So all of them have been working to try to assemble the experiment, commission it, run the experiment, and do physics analyses. So I myself have been working on the Higgs boson searches, among other physics topics at the LHC. Most of the other faculty are involved in, you know, other physics topics, like search for something called the single top production, you know, which is sort of a specialty of the faculty at Michigan State University. Mm. I mean, that's one of the advantages of the Large Hadron Collider. It's not just searching for one thing. The Higgs boson is certainly the most important thing that we've discovered so far, but it's like a fire hose. There's so much physics coming out that it's hard to, you know, do all the physics that can be done.
How about that? It must be awfully exciting for a researcher, though.
It is.
Yeah. Mm. These are huge experiments in terms of size. Describe the collider for us and the tiny space in which this discovery was made.
Well, the collider is 27 kilometers in circumference. Sorry, I have to stay with metric here just because it's hard to think in English terms, but it's 27 kilometers in circumference. It crosses the border between France and Switzerland, so it's very interesting, actually, to go from one part of the laboratory to another. You have to cross an international border. It's about 100 meters underground.
27 kilometers, though. We're talking 13, 14 miles.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. So, but again, you don't see very much evidence of it because it is, you know, 300 feet underground. And so basically it was all mined, you know, a mine shaft was constructed, you know, to put the tunnel in. The ATLAS experiment itself is about 45 meters long and 20 meters, I think, or so high. And it contains as much steel as the Eiffel Tower.
Hmm.
So it's quite a massive thing. In fact, it's very impressive if you take the elevator ride down there. First of all, it's a very long elevator ride that only has 2 stops, you know, for at the very bottom and then about 30 feet above that. And so it's very unusual to have this elevator ride that only has two buttons in it. And then you go out and walk into the cavern, and it's just incredibly immense, this detector.
Have you been to the Large Hadron Collider, Elizabeth Simmons?
I was fortunate enough to visit before they closed off the tunnel and started running, and so the experiments were still being installed. I got to see both the ATLAS and the CMS experiments, and it was striking that the size of the ATLAS experiment, it's at least half as large as Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. It's simply amazing, just this cavernous space that's now all almost completely crammed with equipment, all tightly fit together.
But it's so huge because we have to generate just an incalculable amount of energy here. Is that the reason for the immensity of this thing?
Well, the reason for the immensity of the accelerator, the 27 kilometers, is that we had to reach a new energy regime. So the Fermilab collider outside of Chicago, you know, used to be the highest energy particle accelerator in the world at energy of around 2 trillion electron volts. The Large Hadron Collider now has surpassed that. It has run at 8 trillion electron volts and ultimately will run at 13 to 14 trillion electron volts. So the larger the energy that you try to reach, the larger the accelerator has to be. So that's why 27 kilometers in circumference. You know, it has to be a very large tunnel for that region. The collisions that take place, you know, for the protons that are being accelerated against each other at that energy, produce, you know, particles of very high momentum. And in order to completely measure the properties of the collision, for example, to be able to establish that, you know, a particular event is likely to be a Higgs boson candidate, involves a very massive apparatus, you know, to accurately measure all the properties. And so that's why the detector itself has to be so big.
Connect us to the practical application of this, if you could.
Well, there are a number of different directions. I mean, one is simply in trying to design the accelerator in order to make it powerful enough. Very powerful superconducting magnets had to be employed to steer the protons around in a circle. And so new superconducting magnet technology had to be developed for this, and then that's useful in other industrial applications. Superconductors are used for, say, maglev trains, the bullet trains in Japan and in Europe and so on. A number of improvements in computer technology, for example, the World Wide Web was developed to deal with the data from particle accelerators and the data involved in simply constructing the pieces of an experiment in 100 different countries around the world and putting all those pieces together to fit together to within fractions of millimeters. You had to have really detailed blueprints, as it were. So the World Wide Web is a spin-off. Probably the most important thing that we produce, though, are the students, the educated students who then love science and are going to go on and do something interesting and technological.
That we can't even imagine,
probably. That's right.
Right. As this work continues, are there implications for facilities here at Michigan State, like the cyclotron or the FRIB?
So the FRIB is absolutely going to be the best instrument in its class to look at nuclei of atoms, which are much larger than the particles we're looking at. The Higgs boson, you could fit lots of them inside of the nucleus of an atom. A nucleus is much bigger.
Okay.
So it's as though the FRIB will be like the most powerful jeweler's loop for looking at fine gems. But if you wanted to look at the atoms inside of the gem, you would need something like an electron microscope, just a different kind of instrument.
Okay.
And CERN is the best kind of electron microscope, then, if you will. They're each best in class. They look at different things.
This was originally theorized 50 years ago. Peter Higgs was the first one. His name is attached to this. And he was one of a team of six. Five of these people, I guess I'm told, are still alive. And some of them actually met for the first time at last July's announcement. This is a worldwide project. It's interesting that some of the principals had never met face-to-face before last July.
Well, they were – actually, I didn't realize that. I mean, of course, by now they're quite elderly because they had done this research 50 years ago. But it was nice to have all five of them in the room, you know, hearing this announcement that something very much like the Higgs boson had been discovered. One of them was actually my professor that I had at graduate school at the University of Rochester. So I was very happy to come up to him afterwards and say that so happy that he was there to be able to witness this.
How exciting. What's next? Is the Higgs boson the only one, or is there more to find?
Well, actually, there may be more than one Higgs boson, right? It's only within...
I knew you would say something like that.
It's only within what is called the standard model, sort of the simplest model that we have to understand nature, that there is only one Higgs boson. We know the standard model is incomplete. There are so many questions that it doesn't answer. You know, for example, you know, why is gravity so much weaker than every other force? You know, we know our universe is made up not mostly of ordinary matter. That's only a few percent. We know it's made out of dark, you know, energy and dark matter. We have no idea what those two things are. We hope, for example, that we may be able to produce dark matter candidates at the Large Hadron Collider. We haven't seen any evidence for that so far, but this is just the beginning of our physics research. Hmm. There's so many questions that have to be answered, and we hope that by running at higher energies and higher intensities, that we'll be able to uncover those mysteries.
We have been unraveling the mysteries of the Higgs boson with Joey Houston. He's a professor in the MSU Physics and Astronomy Department, and Dr. Elizabeth Simmons of Lyman Briggs College and also of the MSU Physics and Astronomy Department. Thanks to both of you.
Well, thank you.
Jokes about Jesus' image are everywhere.
I like to picture Jesus in a tuxedo t-shirt because it says, like, I want to be formal, right, but I'm here to party, too, because I like to party, so I like my Jesus to party.
I like to picture Jesus as a ninja fighting off evil samurai.
All right, I'll be the one to say it. How do we know you're really Jesus?
I'm mainly here to correct a major error that you people have been basing the faith on.
What's that?
Jesus wasn't white. Jesus was black.
However, underlying this humor are the conflicts of race, which continue to persist in America. Today I'm joined by Edward Blum, a historian of religion and race in America at San Diego State University and co-author of the book, The Color of Christ, The Son of God and the Saga of Race in America, which looks at how the varied configurations and depictions of Jesus tell the history of race in the United States. Welcome to Current State.
Glad to be here.
Let's look to the Bible first. Are there any descriptions of what Christ looks like, reliable descriptions in the text of what Jesus looks like?
Even though there are four biographies, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, no description of hair, skin tone, eye color, no discussion of that at all.
Any other reliable early depictions of Jesus?
No. For the first couple hundred years, the early church, these were people running around in catacombs. They were, you know, busily getting murdered in Colosseums, so they were not creating images. It wasn't until hundreds of years later that they started to even talk about, can we represent what Jesus looked like?
And in colonial America, the image of a white Jesus takes root. Is that correct?
Yeah, it takes root, though, after the Puritans destroyed images of Jesus. Part of the Protestant Reformation was, hey, these Catholics are violating the Second Commandment against graven images. So America's first colonists didn't have white Jesus images. It wasn't until around the time of the American Revolution and a little bit after that.
Well, are you saying then that there was a wider perception of Jesus as being a person of color in the Catholic Church?
At times there were. In the Middle Ages, there's actually a couple hundred black Madonnas and black Jesus figures kind of circulating all over Catholicism. And if we look at South America, we see the emergence of Our Lady of Guadalupe, who was a mestiza Madonna when the Spanish interacted with Native Americans.
So is that there's a pattern here. The dominant race depicts Jesus according to that dominant race. Is that a general pattern we can say?
It sometimes is if you have a theological inclination to do it. So if you actually want to use images to teach children, and you have to have power, right? To create an image, you have to have time, for instance. You know, slaves don't have time to sit there and, what color do I, you know, how do I want to paint Jesus today? You also have to have stuff. You have to have marble. You have to have paper. You have to have paints. So if you don't have those things, you can't produce it. And then finally, reproduce it. Who has the ability to reproduce an image, whether it's on paper or in film? Only certain people have those powers at certain times.
So over time in the United States, a Jesus of color, does a Jesus of color slowly begin to emerge?
Okay, we have three times where Jesus is non-white, three kind of moments, and they're all in the 20th century. The first is during the Harlem Renaissance, when you get African Americans like W.E.B. Du Bois or Marcus Garvey creating a kind of pro-black culture. Then we get it in the 1950s and the 1960s during the Civil Rights Movement, and we get the rise of black liberation theology from folks like James Cone. And then now more recently, we get black Jesus in our comedic culture. So you can hear Chris Rock, the comedian, talking about, you know, Jesus was black. So those are kind of the three iterations of Jesus as colored throughout America, throughout the 20th century.
Your book looks at how this image of Jesus has been used as a means for suppression as well as a tool for empowerment. Maybe one of the most interesting cases of this dual role is the image of Jesus during slavery. The depiction of Jesus during slavery is that of a white man, yet it's an image that both master and slave take comfort in. How does that work?
So the master sees Jesus as the suffering servant and then tries to teach slaves, like, hey, it's okay that you're a servant. Look, even God's son was a servant, so that's okay. Slaves take it and they meet a white Jesus and this is a Jesus who comes to redeem them, not to rape them. He's a Jesus who listens to them. There was a slave song that went this way. He owns me and I own him. And to think about that, these are people who don't own anything. They're owned by other people. To think that they own the Savior, they own a white man. So in fact, the white Jesus in that capacity, he acts unlike other white men. And so what it does is it kind of takes away white power, even though Jesus himself is white. He's a friend to them, a good man to them, not a terrible man to them.
So beyond slaveholders, are there other groups that have used this image of Christ, in your view, to justify this supremacy?
The most obvious case is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, who create, and this is the Mormons, who have a white Jesus, and they also have a racial theology where Brigham Young argued that if a white person had sex with a person of African descent, that white person should be beheaded. Okay, not just thrown out of the church, but it was that much of a sin. So for them, having a white Jesus was part of that white bodies were more sacred than other bodies.
What do we know about the LDS today? I mean, how has that attitude gone forward here into the 21st century? Is it extinct? Are there signs of it? What?
Well, in 1978, the church had a new revelation that opened up their priesthood to black men. Before 1978, you couldn't be a full member if you had any African descent. So on one hand, they've changed quite a bit since 1978. But before that, in the 1960s, they took a gigantic white marble Jesus and started putting it in their welcome centers. So if you want to go, you know, join the church, you walk through, here's a big, huge white Jesus to welcome you. So it's kind of like, you know, we give with one hand and take away with another.
Do other countries, I mean, is the appropriation of the image of Jesus unique? Is this uniquely American, or this is more widespread?
Well, all, you know, throughout the world, you know, anyone who's dealing with Jesus at some point deals with a material incarnation.
Right.
What's been so fascinating is how in the 20th century, we've become an exporter of Jesus imagery. So if you go to Africa, you can go to parts of Asia and put up a poster of Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ with Jim Caviezel, the actor, playing Jesus on it, you can find locals actually going up to it and touching it as if it's sacred. because of the power of media. The most viewed movie in world history is a film called Jesus. 1 billion people have seen it. All the actors are played by Middle Easterners except for Jesus, who's played by an Englishman. And the film was made in 1970, and so it's become a kind of image for the world. Not that we can find Ethiopian Jesuses, we can find Asian Jesuses, but even the dominant one.
Asian Jesuses.
Yeah, really? known as the brown-skinned one. But these films still play a role, even globally, that we have a global export. Just as Michael Jordan and the Swoosh are exported,
right,
the white Jesus is exported too.
What does the community, there must be a community of historians, reputable historians, who study ethnicity, ethnic movements geographically. What is the, is there any kind of consensus on where Jesus lay amongst members of that community?
How do you mean?
I mean amongst people who study this academically, who study the history of ethnicities in the Middle East 2,000 years ago. Is there any kind of consensus there?
Yeah, so there is a sense that what did Jesus really look like 2,000 years ago? The consensus is brown-skinned, probably short hair, probably short himself, brown eyes. And actually, Popular Mechanics put out a Jesus, what he would have looked like. And so it's that definitely not white, definitely not blue-eyed.
Edward Blom's a historian of religion and race in America at San Diego State University and co-author of the book, The Color of Christ, The Son of God and the Saga of Race in America. Edward, thank you.
Great chatting with you.
That's Current State for today. Our producers are Melissa Benmark, Emmanuel Berry, Kevin Lavery, and Scott Pohl. Peter Worf is our executive producer. Our show is engineered by Aaron Young. Current State's producer is Joe Lindstroth. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State.